You're listening to the Third Degree Environmental and Social Justice Show on TPSCR 107.3. I'm James Hitchcock.
And I'm Simon Unwin. Later on today, we'll be talking about experimental seabed mining. But first thing this morning, it is a bit of a special day, isn't it, James?
It is. If you showed up for work today and you're looking around and wondering why you're the only one there, you're not early. Or if you're like me and you were charged 10% surcharge on a coffee this morning, it is because today is a public holiday and Australia Day, or Sovereignty Day. And it marks the day when the first fleet arrived in Sydney Harbour and the beginning of the colonial period in Australia's history.
So for a lot of people, it's become a day of general celebration of the positive aspects of Australia. Attending poorly organised music festivals, wearing novelty Australian flag board shorts, that sort of thing.
Of course, if you're Aboriginal, the date marking the beginning of occupation, dispossession and ongoing injustice at the hands of colonial oppressors is less novelty board short worthy. And that's why the Australian Aboriginal League and the Aboriginal Progressive Association back in 1938 began to commemorate the day as a day of mourning, and why today in Canberra and other places around Australia it is marked as Sovereignty Day.
So in Canberra, at the Aboriginal Tent Embassy, the Federation of Aboriginal Sovereign Nations will also be convening to discuss issues in and around sovereignty. And as well as this, over the next 2 days, there'll be celebrations marking the 40th anniversary of protests at the site of the Aboriginal Tent Embassy outside Old Parliament House in Canberra.
And if you can't make that 3-hour drive, which, you know, you could, it's not that far really.
No.
In the scheme of things, that drive to Canberra and Sydney, you can head to the Yabun concert. The largest single-day Indigenous festival in the country, and there'll be lots of music, talks and other great stuff. And that's happening at Victoria Park, which is on the corner of Broadway and City Roads in Broadway, right near Sydney Uni, and events and festivities run between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m, so take some time to head down to there today.
Yeah, I mean, we've been there the past few years, and it's really one of the best ways that you can spend Invasion Day, Survival Day, Australia Day, whatever you want to call it. And I guess also happening today and for the next few days, renowned Aboriginal activist Gary Foley will be talking at the Opera House as part of the Sydney Festival. So this show's, the little spiel about the show is sort of saying that, you know, he's spent decades spinning the yarns of Black Australia, both past and present, and he's now using his well-honed skills as a troublemaker, teacher and teller of tales to bring his experience to the stage. So there's a couple of shows happening over the next few days. Tickets are around about $40 and available through the Opera House and Sydney Festival websites.
It looks like it will be a great show, but for those who can't make it, here's a short clip of Gary Foley speaking 10 years ago, addressing a protest in Melbourne.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't think that an apology is enough. I'm sorry, folks, but to me, reconciliation is not justice. Native title is not land rights. It seems to me, in the last 30 years, and especially in the last 10 years, that all of us, both you who were taken away and we who weren't, have been dudded yet again. Most people in this society seem to think, and most probably a lot of people in this audience might like to think, that native title somehow or other has solved all the problems. Well, folks, I strongly suggest you ask the Yorta Yorta people about the Native Title Act. And we're not talking about a Native Title Act that was fiddled with by John Howard. We're talking about a Native Title Act that was given to us by the Hawke and Keating government, folks. So remember that when you get your slimy ALP politicians coming around nowadays making all sorts of promises that they're not going to keep. They haven't kept them in the past and they won't keep them in the future. Remember Bob Hawke when he came to power, folks. He said, national uniform land rights legislation for Aboriginal people. I'm here 2 years later in the face of a vicious, racist, Goebbels-style propaganda campaign on the part of the Australian Mining Industry Council. Bob Hawke wilted, backed off. What did we get instead? We got ATSI. Aborigines talking shit in Canberra. What else did we get? We got reconciliation. Reconciliation, as admirable as it might seem to so many people today, It is still nevertheless something that did not come out of the Australian community. It was not a spontaneous thing that emerged from either the Aboriginal or the broader Australian community. It was created by government as an act of Parliament. You cannot legislate freedom, folks. You cannot legislate justice in that way. 30 years ago, we were talking about land rights. None of this Mickey Mouse native title, the most inferior form of land tenure under British law. We were talking about land rights, freehold title, as we or as the Northern Territory people already had in the 1976 Land Rights Act. In terms of the 76 Land Rights Act, native title is a giant leap backwards. So folks, all I'm saying to you is don't believe the hype. At least show that you're intelligent people by delving a little bit below the surface and seeking the real truths about where we are not at today. I'm sorry, an apology won't provide for the pain, won't provide for the real needs that exist, not only for the stolen generations, but for those who weren't taken. Land rights was important 30 years ago because it would provide a means by which the Aboriginal community could go through the process of reconstruction and recuperation. It provided a means by which we could strive towards economic independence, the only form of genuine freedom that you will get in a society like this. Until Koori communities have got economic independence, they have no freedom. We are still subject to the expectations of a broader community that don't give a damn about us. Don't expect that Kim Beazley is going to give any of you people a damn thing. He won't. He won't until we get people back out in the streets again like we had them 30 years ago. The only time that Indigenous people ever changed the course of Australian history was at the Aboriginal Embassy in 1972. And that came about because of mass action. None of this wishy-washy negotiations in Canberra behind closed doors amongst elite groups. We need mass people action again in Australia to try and resurrect the sentiment that existed in the broader Australian community in 1967, when in the only definitive public opinion poll that's ever been held of the Australian people about what they think about Aboriginal people, 92% voted for justice for Aboriginal people. And I believe that a lot of that sentiment is still out there. So thank you, folks. That's all I got to say.
And that was Gary Foley, Aboriginal activist, addressing a crowd at a protest in Melbourne 10 years ago. And he'll be sharing his thoughts and experiences and stories on stage the next few days. So head to the Opera House website for full details about that.
But for the rest of the program today, we're actually going to turn to the next big thing in the international mining industry, deep sea mining or seabed mining. So yes, it is what you think, giant robots at the bottom of the ocean mining the sea floor. So if that sounds a little bit like science fiction, then you might be surprised that in the Bismarck Sea in Papua New Guinea, Canadian mining company Nautilus Minerals has actually won approval from the PNG government to embark on a large commercial mining project more than 1,000 metres under the surface of the sea, mining mineral deposits around hydrothermal sulphur vents on the sea floor. So the Solwara 1 project, as it's called, is the first of its kind, and civil society groups in East New Britain province and environmentalists around the world have raised concerns about the impacts that the project might have. So we spoke late last year to Professor Helen Rosenbaum, who's written a report titled Out of Our Depth, and it details some of those concerns. I started by asking her what exactly the project will involve.
Okay, well, deep sea mining is basically mining these huge mounds that are formed around things called hydrothermal vents. I tend to think of these hydrothermal vents as being like thousands of mini volcanoes sitting, well, in Solwara 1's case, sitting 1.6 kilometres under the water. And they've been spewing out this very sulphide and metal-rich ash for thousands of years. In Solwara 1's case, it's thought they could have been active for 5,000 years. So they form these huge mounds. Basically, the mining companies look at these mounds and just see a huge minerals playground. They just think all they need to do is go down there, scrape these mounds up, pipe them up to the top in a riser pipe to a barge, head them off to Rebel for storage, and then they're taking them somewhere else for processing. They haven't decided yet where they're going to be concentrating the ore. But what we know is that every step of the process comes with risks of environmental impacts. And some of these impacts have been identified in the environmental impact statement on which the 20-year mining lease has been based, and many of them have not been identified in that. And that's what's of concern to us, that there's high risks, high uncertainty. It's an untested form of mining, although the technologies used in the mining are actually borrowed from sea and oil drilling. And I think that in itself is a worry. I think most of us have quite clear images still of the Gulf oil spill and the environmental destruction that it caused, and how difficult it was to sort out that technological problem. And similarly, with Solwara 1, you're working in really sort of unusual conditions of great depth, of great pressure, seismic activity in that area. And it's a tropical area that's prone to, you know, tropical storms. So there's a lot of scope there for things to go wrong technologically with the equipment, as well as the direct impacts on these vents and their very unique ecosystems.
An exotic garden of marine life. Species without eyes. Others resembling Triassic-era fossils, over 200 million years old.
I wonder if you could talk a little more about those. We know that they are quite rare or very interesting ecosystems, and there's not a lot that we know about them. Is that
no? And that's sort of one of the tragedies of this, that many species around these vents are going to be destroyed and rendered extinct, perhaps, before they've even been identified. The conditions around the vents are unlike anywhere else on the planet. And that's resulted in these really unique ecosystems. As I said before, they're at a depth of 1.6 kilometres. The pressure is very high at that depth. The mineral chemistry results in quite high acidity. And there's this unique combination of very hot water coming up through the vents, mixing with very cold seawater that sits at the sea bottom. So all those quite unusual circumstances result in this quite strange and wonderful ecosystem. And it's, as you said, it's quite true that we're just barely starting to understand these ecosystems. Of course, it's very expensive to do research down there. Most of the research that's been done has been done by mining companies, and Nautilus's EIS and the associated studies have probably added quite a lot to the knowledge base that we do have about these ecosystems. But still, we're just barely understanding what goes on down there, how these ecosystems may link with some other ecosystems higher up in the water. And we really don't know what impact it's going to have to be mining a whole vent field. So it's not just mining one or two of these vents. They're going to be mining 11 square kilometres of vents in the first instance with just the Solwara 1 project. And within that is a vent field of thousands of vents. So no one knows. It's a huge experiment. So basically, they're experimenting with this first mining project.
Nautilus seemed to be arguing that because the project is so far out to sea and so far down, you know, right at the bottom of the ocean, 1.6 kilometres below the surface, that the impacts on other ecosystems further up that are more important to, you know, to the local people in terms of fisheries and cultural traditions, they're arguing that those will be relatively unaffected. Now, how do you respond to those kinds of assertions?
Well, show us the studies that demonstrate that that's the case. To date, and what we're calling for in the report that we've released is we've identified the different kinds of studies that we feel still need to be undertaken in order to demonstrate that marine life and coastal communities are not going to be poisoned. We still have not seen the research on which Nautilus can confidently base that, and our report actually just asks for these different kinds of studies to be done and put out there in the public domain so they can be independently vetted and scrutinised. Nautilus in this coming year, 2012, are going to be working on the environmental management plan. They've been granted a 20-year mining lease, and we still don't know how they're going to address the impacts, even just those impacts that they've identified, let alone all the impacts that they haven't yet identified. The sea is an interconnected space. There's no sort of cut-off point or barriers in the sea. It's just a matter of time before impacts from one part of the ocean will be felt in another part of the ocean. So part of the process, the mining process, is to, on the barge, when the ore is taken up from, the minerals are taken up to the barge through the riser pipe from the bottom, up from that 1.6 kilometre depth, there's a dewatering process that occurs on the barge. So what they want to do is to filter out the water, so what they take back to Rabaul Port is more or less, you know, a thicker slurry. And so that water is going to be piped back down to lower down where it's going to be released. That'll result in a plume, and the modelling in the EIS has shown that that plume could spread up to 10 kilometres squared. And in that plume are going to be heavy metals. There's going to be a lot of metals that have leached out of the slurry that are going to be released back down into the water. So that indicates how these metals are going to move through the ocean under different current conditions that exist there, under different weather patterns. And one of the things that's of concern to us is in an area where there's an underwater active volcano about a kilometre away from the Solwara site and another very active volcano on land about 40 kilometres away, is that this is an area of quite high seismic activity. So where's the modelling that shows that there could not be some quite significant upwelling from the lower layers where they're depositing this water from the slurry back up into the higher levels of the marine environment.
So that's Professor Helen Rosenbaum speaking there about the risks involved with the world's first deep sea mining project. Local people in East New Britain, near where the mining will occur, also not happy about being test subjects. So here's Patrick Kaupun, an activist from East Pomeo on East New Britain. He's speaking pidgin here, so I'll read you the translation afterwards. I'll just give you a short soundbite of, an interview that was conducted with him.
Tami plaharim olsem notolus na technology which boligisim em first time loligisim deslakan technology lo Papua New Guinea. Mi play film olsem East New Britain em kamapolsem science lab na. Na mi play ba kamapolsem all creatures which bolitestim mi play. Na whatever life me play stop long ame em by also experiment blo desla technology blo notolus na whole world which me play no like him through desla kind me play human being na me play got right lo stop na maintain him identity me blo also human being me play no something which by easy long nar plaman of foreign I come use him kind also lo me play so me play get I no like him through notolus long conduct him any mining inside long ground blo me play.
When we first heard that Nautilus was going to mine the seabed using technology that had never been used anywhere else, it felt as though East New Britain was becoming a science lab, and we were the creatures who were going to be test subjects. And our very lives would become part of an experiment to test this new technology brought in by Nautilus. Well, we don't want that. We are human beings, and we'd like to maintain our identity as human beings. We are not things to be used by foreigners. We don't want Nautilus to mine our land. On the Third Degree at 2SER, we're talking today about what some people are calling the next gold rush, but it's going to be an underwater one. Professor Helen Rosenbaum is the author of A Damning Report into the Risks Involved in the World's First Commercial Deep Sea Mining Project. Her report claims that there are many crucial gaps in Nautilus Minerals' environmental impact statement. And we pick up again halfway through our chat, where Professor Rosenbaum argues that the precautionary principle should be used for this kind of development.
It's been talked about a lot just recently at regional meetings about deep sea mining.
Okay.
And, so I thought I might just mention what that entails and how it puts responsibility on them to actually prove that they're not causing harm, not for us to actually prove they are. Well, even though Nautilus are quite confidently telling us that there's no problem with, there's not going to be any impacts caused to marine life up on the upper layers of the ocean or to communities. We are yet to see any studies or the research results or the reports that demonstrate that. And one principle that's been talked about quite recently and quite, you know, people have been quite vocal about is the precautionary principle. 2 weeks ago, there was a meeting in Fiji hosted by the International Seabed Authority and the South Pacific Community, looking specifically at the environmental management requirements for deep sea mining. And this is a principle that scientists at that meeting and also the director of SOPAC, which runs a program looking at deep sea mining, actually discussed at length the need to apply the precautionary principle. So the precautionary principle is an internationally accepted principle. In some legal systems, it's actually mandated as law, for example, in the European Union. And what it states is, in a nutshell, is that if a development has a risk of causing harm to the public or to the environment, the burden of proof that the development is not harmful falls on the developers. So that means Nautilus and the government of Papua New Guinea have the responsibility to prove to us, to civil society, to the communities that are likely to be impacted, or that are close to the Solwara 1 development, that they are not going to be poisoned by the activities of the mine. It's not incumbent on civil society, who don't have the resources and don't necessarily have all the necessary expertise, to prove that it is going to cause harm. What we've done with our report is ask some really serious questions, identify gaps that need to be filled, and we're actually calling on the Papua New Guinea government to delay progress with the mine until those gaps are filled.
Yeah, you mentioned the Papua New Guinea government there, and they are very much partners in this project, I suppose. They have a 30% stake in the Solwara 1 project. What do you think that means for possible regulation of the Solwara 1 project and others like it?
Well, the Papua New Guinea government has retained an option to take up a 30% share. So because the operation, commercial operation, hasn't started yet, I guess they're not at this point quite yet a 30% partner. But of course, what it will do will compromise regulation of the mine. We've seen that in the case of other mines in Papua New Guinea, for example, the Ok Tedi mine up in the highlands in western province of Papua New Guinea. The same thing occurred there. The Papua New Guinea government was a significant shareholder in the mine. The Department of Environment and Conservation were quite constrained in what they could do to monitor and regulate the operations of that mine. And 1,000 kilometres of river system has been rendered pretty much biologically dead by the tailings from that mine being poured into it for almost 30 years now. So I don't think it augurs well, even though this might be seen as a way to increase the benefits back to Papua New Guinea, it does not augur well for the regulation of the mine. And just in terms of benefits, the benefits from this mine would appear, based on Nautilus's own estimates, to be quite small in comparison to the risks. For the Solwara 1 project, there's likely to be 100 jobs generated. Most of those will go to expatriate workers. There's going to be a $1.5 million development fund established. And that sounds like an awful lot of money to people living in remote villages. But when you compare it to what they expect to gross, which is $1 billion US over 2.5 years, which is the life of the mine, the $1.5 million is really quite paltry.
And I imagine there are a number of other mining companies observing closely how this is handled in the Solwara 1 case, because obviously if this experiment goes well, then there will be a whole lot of other resources that they'll want to be exploiting elsewhere in the Pacific.
Well, we know the International Seabed Authority, which has jurisdiction over, it's a UN body that's been set up to regulate mining of the sea floor. But what it seems to be doing really is doling out exploration licences. It doesn't seem to have any jurisdiction over conserving the biological resources of the seafloor, which is also quite a worry. But we do know that the ISA has been handing out licences to many other companies. So there's many thousands of square kilometres of seafloor in the Pacific already taken up with exploration licences for these companies. We know there's companies from Japan, from the UK, from Russia, from Korea, from China, just to mention a few, who have interests in the Pacific seafloor. So they're all just sitting there in the wings. They're waiting to see how Nautilus goes technologically and regulation-wise and financially. And if it all goes smoothly, they're going to be in there like a shot. So we can expect a gold rush on the seafloor of the Pacific. And whilst we don't even know what the impacts of this first single mining venture is going to be, we have absolutely no idea what the impacts, the cumulative impacts of all these very many mines would be. And Nautilus itself has already got over 500,000 square kilometres of seafloor assigned to it for exploration. The impacts could be devastating.
When I first heard about the project, I just thought, wow, you know, we're getting to that point where I guess our thirst for mineral resources is pushing us to actually, you know, send robots down to the bottom of the sea. And we've actually been doing a following a story about the rare earths processing plant that an Australian company is trying to set up in Malaysia. So,
well, many people talk about the drivers for deep sea mining being the need for the high demand by society for rare earths that are used in mobile phones, other often quoted uses, wind turbines, hybrid cars, and military applications. So,
smartphones and smart bombs.
That's right. Mm. So, you know, our question is really, you know, are we really saying that we value mobile phones more than we do deep sea ecosystems and the well-being of communities that rely on marine food, a species close to Solwara 1 mine? You know, is it not possible for us to recycle our mobile phones? Think about how many are discarded each year that, you know, could be readily recycled for these rare earths. If only the pricing mechanisms in the world were such that it was attractive to recycle rather than to scoop up metals from the bottom of the seafloor or to dig more holes on land. Mm. I think another driver for deep sea mining is that it's truly out of sight, out of mind. No one's going to be able to see what's going on down there. There's very high grades of ore, and no one apart from the companies is going to know what damage is really being done down there. So unlike land-based mines where it's out in the open, even in remote locations these days, people can take photos and you know, electronically distribute images around the world, down there it's truly out of sight and they're unaccountable.
Yeah, there's actually, if you read the Nautilus press materials and consultation materials about this project, there is almost that note of glee that, you know, that it's so remote. It's inaccessible, and in fact, by their reckoning, there are no directly affected landholders. So,
it's,
you know,
perfect.
Exactly. You know that they're sort of saying we weren't even sure who to consult with. You know, if we had to consult, but we're just doing it anyway because we're such a nice company. But yeah, no, it's very obvious from their communications that that this is a major advantage of this kind of project is that it's at the bottom of the sea. So you're on the Third Degree, and we were speaking there with Professor Helen Rosenbaum about her report on the Solwara 1 seabed mining project. And that's titled Out of Our Depth. And yeah, if you search seabed mining, that should be one of the first things that comes up if you want to have a look at that report.
Thanks, Simon. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. We have been the Third Degree, and my name is James Hitchcock.
And I'm Simon Unwin. We'll see you next week. Thank you.